Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Damn It. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel, and joining me in studio, I'm very proud to announce Dr. Scott J. Kolbaba, a doctor, MD, who has a book out that I'm holding in my hot little hands here, Physicians Untold Stories. Scott, thanks for being in studio.
It's great to be here, Jennifer. Thanks.
Now, I was introduced to you through our mutual friend, Chris Fleming, who is a well-known psychic medium based here in the Chicago area, but he's been on programs internationally. He's, I believe, shooting a series right now in London.
He is, yes.
Okay. So Chris has worked with you, talked with you, been privy to some of the information that you have. But let's rewind the clock for the listeners and for other people who don't know your background. You have a medical background and you've experienced some incredible things. Talk to me about how you started compiling the stories for this book.
Well, you know, I'm an ordinary doc. I see regular patients every day. I love that. I've done it for 35 years, although I can't believe it's been actually 35 years.
You started when you were 11. I've heard it before. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I have kids now that are older than I am. It's very hard to believe. And I had some unusual experiences, and I couldn't explain them. Mm-hmm. And I decided to write a couple down, and then I wondered if these would be reasonable to publish. So I, every doctor has patients that do every kind of profession you can imagine, mm-hmm. including that profession. And so I have a publisher who I contacted, and I said, his name is Scott McDonald, and I said, Scott, could you meet me for lunch and listen to some of these stories and tell me if they're worth anything?
Sure.
Because I didn't know, and these were interesting stories. And, you know, doctors don't talk about unusual stories and spiritual stories. Doctors talk about potassiums, and they talk about the next patient that's going to have the gallbladder surgery the next day and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I sat down with Scott at a restaurant, and we were talking. And I was really hungry, so I didn't have a chance to look up. I was just eating and telling stories. And all of a sudden, I noticed he stopped eating, and he stopped totally. And I thought, this is strange. So I looked up, and he had tears in his eyes. Mm. And I thought, my goodness, if these stories can move a publisher that much, maybe they're valuable. Maybe I should do something with them.
Right.
And that's when I decided to go ahead and write a book that would take me 6 months. Unfortunately, as you know, you've written some books. Mm-hmm. 4 years later,
right.
I finally finished.
Yeah.
Two editors, two publishers, two attorneys, and so forth. And it chronicles unusual stories and really miraculous stories that doctors have experienced, mm-hmm. that they don't talk about.
So I would love to start with the first one that you scribbled down. Everybody remembers the first one they scribbled down. So what's the first one you scribbled down?
The first one happened on the floor of the hospital, and mm-hmm. I was just making rounds. And all of a sudden, my friend Dave Mokel, who is an orthopedic surgeon, runs up to me and grabs me by the arm. And he says, Scott, I've got to tell you this incredible story. I said, great, tell it to me. And he said, well, I can't tell it to you here. And I said, well, why not? He said, someone might hear me.
Oh, jeez.
So I got my curiosity. Mm-hmm. So I said, let's go into an empty patient room. And we did, and he closed the door. And he said, I want to tell you about Mary. Mary is a mutual patient that had ankle surgery.
Okay.
She was on the operating table, and she arrested. The arrest was pretty much a result of antibiotics that they'd given her. She mm-hmm. had an anaphylactic reaction to the antibiotic.
Oh, dear.
She totally was dead. She was flatlined, no pulse, no respirations, no response to pain, eyes closed, basically dead. One of the techs that came from another room, when they called the code, started to do CPR. He wasn't doing it adequately enough, so Dr. Mokel decided to ask him gently to step aside. Well, you know, in the throes of battle, he didn't step aside, and after a couple of requests, Dr. Mokel, who was in charge of the code and wanted to make sure that she was going to live, decided to push him away. So he pushed him aside.
Yep.
He had bright orange hair, or bright red hair, underneath his operating room cap. And Dr. Mokel started to do the CPR, did it successfully. She started to come back. She never woke up until the next day. And then she did make it. She lived. And after a couple of days, she was ready to go home. And they found out it was the antibiotic that was the culprit. Mm-hmm. And when Dr. Mokel came in to give her the discharge recommendations, she said, thank you for saving my life. And it was such a sweet way to say that. It kind of took Dr. Mokel aside. But mm-hmm. but he's a humble guy. And he said, well, you know, it was a team effort. We had a lot of cardiologists and lots of people were involved. And she said, no. I saw you push that guy with the red hair away, and I saw you take over the CPR, and then you saved my life. And by this time, Dr. Mokel got weak knees and started to sat down, and he was trying to explain this scientifically because he's a pretty scientific kind of a guy, and he couldn't explain it. And then she went on to tell him all the details of the arrest, all the people that came in the room, what they were wearing, mm-hmm. Every little detail. And he couldn't understand how she did that.
When she was flatlined.
When she was flatlined.
Right.
Right, when she was basically dead.
She was a witness in the room.
She was.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, when I arrested, I rose up to the top of the room, and I was watching everything that happened, and I could see exactly what happened. I could see you page Dr. Kolbaba, that you wanted to have him come in. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in the hospital, but he paged me a couple times. She mentioned all the details. And then she said, my grandmother, who had been dead for many years, also came to me and told me it wasn't my time to go, that I would have to be a kind and wonderful and loving person, and then there would be a special place for me in heaven. Mm. But I'd have to go back, and that's when she developed the heartbeat and really came back to life. And so Dr. Mokla's thinking, I couldn't explain this.
Right.
I said,
and why did he think you were an ear that would be okay with this?
Well, you know, I asked him that. I said, Dave, who did you tell this story to? And he said, my wife. And I said, well, who else? He said, no one.
Mm-hmm.
It was my patient, so it was a mutual patient, so he felt a little secure there. But I think he just had to tell, you know how you get something that you just have, you're bubbling to tell someone.
Right.
And I think he trusted me, I'm a good friend,
yeah.
not to tell anyone else. And then I put it in the book and tell
did you get his permission?
I did.
Okay, good.
All the legal stuff is handled.
Right.
So, I wondered why the other docs gave me permission. These are unusual stories. These are stories that doctors could be criticized for. You know, if you went to your doctor and he said, I've had a vision about you or I had a dream or something, you'd think this guy's a little bit screwy.
Right, right.
But I think the doctors trusted that I wouldn't mix up their story, that I would tell their reasonable story.
With integrity from a scientific mind.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I also think doctors, again, don't talk about spiritual things. They don't talk about their inner feelings very much at all. I don't think any doctors shared their inner feelings with me until I started to write this book.
Right.
And what I discovered was that many doctors, most doctors, I would say, are really what I call in the book sappy do-gooders. Mm-hmm. They want to do good in the world every day. They want to save someone. They want to help someone out. They want to cure cancer, whatever. And I think the desire to do good, to help people understand that there is something else out there, that there is a force higher than us that loves us and helps us in our day-to-day lives, was greater than the risk that they took of being ostracized by their patients and other doctors for telling these incredible stories.
So I interviewed Dr. Mary Neal, who I'm sure you're familiar
yes.
with, from To Heaven and Back, and she's
yes.
in my third book, This Isn't the Life I Ordered, and as an orthopedic surgeon herself,
yes.
to come and say, I am a pragmatist. I don't make up stories. I don't believe in fables. You know, she's like, I'm a scientist, and I know I was in the light. I know I was without oxygen for 30 minutes, and that's a living miracle.
Yes.
So how is it that we can embrace a living miracle, but then we kind of want to push these stories into this other category, like it's not real or it's not something that we should be talking about all the time? I think it is. I think it's miracles that are happening moment by moment. And thankfully, you are a doctor that's documenting them, because I would guess there are so many more doctors like you all.
You know, I think there are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason that people don't talk about these things is they're afraid of being criticized.
Yes.
And what I've discovered is, and you know, we had a launch about a year ago for the book, and many of the doctors came, and they were a little afraid of what the reaction would be. Would people criticize them, you know, oh, I don't believe this, and so forth. The reaction was just the opposite, and we have had nothing but positive reactions since.
Right, like, thank goodness.
And that's what people are saying.
Yes.
They're saying, and do they say that to you, too?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm so glad someone's talking about this, Jen, because my little three-year-old is
exactly.
yapping at the ceiling, and it's Grandma Nini, and she knows all these things about Nini and her angels. And, you know, I get that three-year-olds have active imaginations.
Yes.
But a doctor coming forth and saying, give us a couple more stories, doctor, because I'm sure you've got a whole hip pocket full of them.
Oh, there's a bunch of stories.
Well, what was about your first encounter with this?
My first encounter was with, and you'd appreciate this, it was on a vacation.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, I was an only child, and I was the only grandchild, so I was never spoiled, of course, at all.
Not at all. As a mother of an only child. No, not at all.
And we used to go on vacations, and I loved to go on vacations with my family. And in those days, we didn't have much money, so we took a driving vacation without air conditioning, without expressways.
Right.
And I don't remember saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet for the 1,000-mile trip? But
right.
All I can remember is the fond experiences that we had on vacations, Yellowstone, places like that. Mm-hmm. So I love to take my family on vacation. Now, I have 7 kids. Don't ask me, Jennifer, where they all came from.
But Holy Mastacholi, you're my hero. Anyone with more than one is my hero. Go on.
We've adopted a bunch. I'm not sure which ones anymore because they all blend in together. When they're good, they're good. When they're bad, they're bad.
Oh, that's great.
And so I'd like to take all my kids on vacation. I live for the vacations. And this one particular vacation was in Cape Cod. Have you ever been to Cape Cod before?
I haven't, but I've been on the East Coast, and I can only imagine I'll love it as much as I love the other areas that I've visited
it's
there.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
They've got wonderful beaches. The mm-hmm. seafood's incredible. Everyone in my family, like me, likes to eat. And
sure.
We love all the stuff that we get on the East Coast. And this one particular vacation, you know, there are some days when everything comes together and you want to pinch yourself. It's just such a perfect day.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone is getting along. We had about 20 people on vacation with us, all the kids, grandkids. And it was toward the evening. We were making dinner. And then on the vacation, the boys cook, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and we're pretty good, actually. We made swordfish steaks on the grill, corn on the cob. And when we were at the store, we bought some pies. And, you mm-hmm. know, for 20 people or so, we needed about 5 pies. So we had there was a big stack of cherry pies. We bought the pies. And as we were checking out, the boys started to talk about what kind of pies were their favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone thought that Grandma Kolbaba's, who'd passed away a number of years before that, rhubarb pie was the most special. And we had a big rhubarb plant in our backyard. And she, at the end of the season, she'd pick all the rhubarb stalks that I hadn't picked out and mm-hmm. used as fans. And she'd make rhubarb pie.
Right.
And the rhubarb pie was so sweet and so delicious that when we go to her house, we'd sneak into the kitchen, sneak in quotation marks.
Right.
And she knew exactly what was going on. We didn't believe in the germ theory, so we all grabbed spoons.
Right.
We went right at the pie and started to eat.
Right.
And we finished the pies up, and they were just absolutely delicious pies. And we said, you know, if Grandma Kolbaba was here, she'd make us a rhubarb pie. And, you know, she'd love to have this moment. We went back, and at the end of the dinner, my wife served the cherry pie. And, you know, it was just... There are days when there are some days when you remember things mm-hmm. like...
Moment to moment.
Yeah. When 9/11 hit, where were mm-hmm. you? This
yes.
is one of those days where I would remember this the rest of my life, this mm-hmm. one particular day. The sun was setting. The kids were having fun. Everyone was talking, laughing. And I took a bite of the cherry pie. And all of a sudden, I got goosebumps, and I had to turn around because the cherry pie wasn't cherry. It was rhubarb.
What?
I looked at the box.
Yep.
It said cherry pie.
Yep.
I took another bite. It was definitely rhubarb pie, a sweet rhubarb pie.
What?
So after my goosebumps disappeared, I thought to myself, you know, it certainly could be a possibility that the factory mixed up the pies,
sure.
that they put a rhubarb pie in a cherry pie box.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I think my mother was there.
Absolutely.
Celebrating that special time with us mm-hmm. with rhubarb pie. And she wanted to let me know that she was there.
You know, another grandma story very similar to that. A friend of mine had a grandmother that she used to garden with,
mm-hmm.
and they had carrots. It was always about the carrots, and they would, you know, she tended to the carrots and absolutely loved this memory with her grandmother, and she had found out that her grandmother had passed, and she was so sad and actually literally crying about it on her front porch.
Yeah.
And then she went to go run errands. She came back, and she swore she saw her grandmother on the front porch in the rocking chair, and she was so startled by it because
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, obviously she was dead.
Sure.
So she went into the house, and then she, you know, her husband said, "You got to look at this. You got to look at this." She goes out back, and there are magically carrots all over the garden. Nothing had been planted.
Wow.
Nothing had been there the day before. Nothing mm-hmm. had grown. It was out of nowhere carrots mm-hmm. in the dirt. Now everybody says to her, "Oh, you just didn't see them," or you know what? That's impossible.
Right.
You get that a lot. That's impossible, right?
You know. I really don't.
Well, good.
I'm surprised.
Because you have the MD behind your name. If I just stayed in school and tried harder. but that's wonderful to hear.
And that was shocking to me.
Yeah.
What was surprising to me and all the doctors that, mm-hmm. that I've worked with.
Yeah.
We're very surprised that people aren't saying, oh, this is bunk or we don't believe this or,
right.
You know, come on, give me a break here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very surprising. And what the response has been is, let me tell you my story.
Yeah.
Thank goodness you told your story.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you mine. So I'm always late in the exam room because patients are always telling me their stories about miraculous experiences.
Well, give me another doctor version that's here in the Physician's Untold Stories book.
One of my favorites is Grandma O'Hanlon. I love grandma stories. And
oh, sure.
This is about Grandma O'Hanlon, who Jack Heitzler is the obstetrician gynecologist. He actually delivered one of our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And our child that he delivered is still talking and walking. And
that's good news.
A member of society.
Good.
And his wife was delivering. He had a bunch of kids, too. I think mm-hmm. he had 7 or 8, and his wife was delivering their 5th child.
Okay.
And it was a normal delivery, and he wasn't participating. He was just in the room. You know, he likes to let the other obstetrician do the delivery. Mm-hmm. And she began to experience some pain. And so they decided then to give her some trilene, which was a drug of choice in those days. It was a mask they put on a woman's face, and they put her to sleep, and then she doesn't obviously feel any pain. Well, Joan Heitzler, who is his wife, who was delivering the baby, had befriended Grandma O'Hanlon. Grandma O'Hanlon was her grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And Grandma O'Hanlon came from Ireland, and she became a midwife in Chicago. And she delivered babies and helped the mothers in the Irish community, which was kind of looked down upon at the time.
Sure.
And so,
and had she passed away by the time she was having this delivery?
She came back to save Joan's life. And she walked into the delivery room. She was dressed in her little polka dot dress.
And the other obstetrician saw her.
I don't think anyone saw her except Joan.
Except Joan.
She stood at the head of the bed, the end of the bed.
And
she signaled to Joan, don't use the trilene. Don't take the trilene.
Uh-huh.
And Joan didn't understand why, but she pushed it away.
Okay.
And no one realized that about 2 hours before Joan went into labor, she had a very large meal, maybe an hour before.
Right.
And about 1 minute after Joan pushed the trilene mask away that would have put her into a deep sleep, she vomited the entire meal.
Oh, my gosh.
Had she had the mask on,
she would have choked.
Aspirated
and
may have died.
Yes.
So Grandma O'Hanlon, she said, saved my life that day. And the interesting part was that Grandma O'Hanlon had died 22 years before.
22 years.
Yeah.
Good thing she's still doing her job, right?
So
she's watching over those she loves.
Yeah, I think people do.
So let me ask you that. As an MD, mm-hmm. what are your beliefs? That one experience with the soul floating over and knowing mm-hmm. which doctor saved her life, witnessing the entire encounter.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have a lot of those stories as well. Is that a soul? Is that a spirit? Is it both? What do you think is happening? What do you think happens when we die?
I think our spirit goes somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and I think our spirits can be aware of our loved ones and others,
mm-hmm.
and I think they can sometimes participate in our lives and help us in strange and wonderful ways, as evidenced by Grandma O'Hanlon.
I was having lunch with a woman the other day who told me that her mother, who's from Georgia, when she comes up in her mind and when she's thinking about her, and she passed away, she sees a Georgia license plate. Or when she's really down in the dumps, you know, out of nowhere, she sees a Georgia license plate. And for me, my dad will appear as a cardinal. Now, cardinals are everywhere in Illinois, so that's not as unusual. But one time I was thinking about him very heavily. I was about to go MC an event where he would have been the MC, but I was stepping in his place. And the car in front of me had the license plate JTW45.
Oh, wow.
JTW were his initials, John Timothy Weigel. 45 was the year he was born. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, that's just a coincidence. That's what the skeptics like to say.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Neal, who was dead for 30 minutes, says every time you think that's a coincidence, you have to stop and say, no, actually, it is bigger. It's something bigger. She believes God. You can say what you want, the universe, God, Jesus, whatever you want to believe, but that it's something greater than what we are, orchestrating that to happen. And when you acknowledge it and say, thank you, I acknowledge that, it happens so frequently that you can't explain it through the law of probabilities. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes. And I think you, once you start realizing these coincidences, you'll see more of them in your life.
Yeah.
And that was one of the points of my book, that people need to look for those little coincidences, that a chance meeting on an elevator of someone that happened to get you a job that you were looking for, or some strange things that you didn't expect, and all of a sudden there's a coincidence about something.
Mm-hmm.
There's one of my patients told me an interesting story. His father died. I took care of his father.
Yeah.
And the father was really a very dynamic individual. And if you knew him, you would say, you know, when he died, you'll really miss him.
Mm-hmm.
And so the son was really missing his dad, my patient, and his name was Leroy.
Mm-hmm.
And he got into his car and was driving somewhere and said a prayer while he was driving. And he said, Father, tell me, you know, give me a sign that Leroy, my dad, is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And at that very instant, a moving truck passed him, and it said on the side of the moving truck, Leroy is moving.
And so Leroy's moving.
I'm getting all these stories now from my patients.
Yes.
This wasn't the doctor's story, but this was a really interesting story. And these are the stories that people are telling me.
Yes.
And they're feeling okay about about sharing the story, because before, people, I don't think, would feel comfortable. And hopefully, if they read books like yours and books like mine, they will begin to realize that these things are happening for a reason, and it's okay to tell about them.
It is. And not only when you start telling it, you make it a safe space for it to start occurring and for you to start realizing it and chronicling your own experiences.
Exactly.
You
exactly.
said that when you pulled up my book on Amazon, Psychics, Healers, and Mediums, it suggested your book as people are also buying.
That was so bizarre.
And then the same, the flip side, when you pick up your book on Physicians Untold Stories on Amazon, it says people are also buying Psychics, Healers, and Mediums by Jennifer Weigel. What?
I took a picture of that last night because I had to check you out a little bit.
A little bit, yes.
I wanted to see what your history was, your bio and so forth, and I looked at your books. And there I was, in your on your site on Amazon, and there you were on my site.
Isn't that something?
And I got goosebumps because I thought this is, what a coincidence. You know about coincidence.
Absolutely. Right? And a lot of the people I've interviewed who have the gift that I don't have, people seem to think that I'm talking to dead people. I said, no. I interview people who say they do.
Yes.
I have yet to experience a visual of some sort or seeing grandma on the porch, in her rocking chair. But, people will tell me that they see things or that things happen a lot like that, and then they're afraid. They keep it close to the chest, and
exactly.
They don't want it. I want to share a story with you about my grandmother, Virginia. She had this piece of furniture that has been in the family since 1950-something, right? She got it from a church. It was a baptismal font.
Okay.
And this is something where they used to baptize the babies in a Lutheran church. Her father was a Lutheran minister, so she found this in an antique store and had to have it.
Yep.
It was the most awkward thing, Dr. Kalava. I mean, seriously, it didn't really fit well in any room, but it looked great with a little Christmas tree on top of it or some pictures. But it was an octagon shape, and it was just monstrous. So after my father passed away, I took it on and moved it from a few houses. And it was time to move again, and there just was not room for this thing.
Yeah.
And I was really sad about it because I had had it for so long. So I reached out to every cousin, brother, you name it. Nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted the baptismal font. So I've been praying to Virginia and just going, gosh, please, I don't know what to do. I don't want you to be mad. I don't want you to be disappointed. So I decided to call a few antique stores.
Okay.
And I thought, I'm not going to take less than $500 for this thing because it's probably worth a couple thousand because it's so old. It actually dated back to the early 1900s. So this guy comes and he's looking around and he says, I'll give you $200 for it. I'm like, $200? Now, I had a couple of other things I wanted to look at, but I was so mad. I stormed outside and I was crying to Virginia like, what the heck? I can't give this to him for $200. I should tell him to go, right? Should I just tell him to go? Still hear nothing, crickets.
Sure.
So I go back in and he says, you have so many Virginia bluebells. And I was like, excuse me? He was pointing to the blue flowers outside that, by the way, Scott, had never been there, these blue flowers.
Interesting.
I had never noticed them before. Like you with the rhubarb pie.
Yep.
They were there that April, but they'd never been there before, and they were all over the field. And there's this flower called the Virginia bluebell, and my grandmother's name is Virginia. He goes, when I moved here, I actually took a bunch of them from Iowa, and I transplanted them here. Now is the perfect time to relocate them.
Interesting.
I'm like, did you just say now is the perfect time to relocate Virginia? So he then offers me a couple hundred more for a table. I had $100 more for another, $50 for this. By the time we were done, he had $500 of things that I didn't want at all. I was going to give to charity and the baptismal font, which, of course, I loved.
Yeah.
He took them, and I was still sad about it. My brother called right after, and I told him the whole story about the Virginia bluebells, everything, and he said, Jen, Virginia was giving you permission to relocate her. She never wanted to be a burden. She was the last one to bed and the first one up. And if she thought for a second you were holding on to that furniture because it was a burden to you and it would have been a financial burden to put it in storage, never would have been okay with that. And
That's
I thought,
awesome.
Wonderful. Now, skeptics, I have a skeptical journalist friend who thinks I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, that I've just totally lost my godforsaken mind.
Yes.
And even the doctors that I interview, he says, coincidence, all of it.
Yes.
So to that gentleman, and I'm going to forward him this podcast, what would you say?
I would say, look at the things that are happening around you.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the things that have influenced your life, and you will always find something. Have you heard Steve Jobs talk at Stanford University before he died?
I'm sure I have.
He gave a talk at Stanford University, and he said he was a college student.
Mm-hmm.
His parents were not very wealthy, and he went to a very expensive small college.
Yeah.
And he hated it. He didn't like going to school. He didn't like having to take classes and so forth. So he dropped out, and he thought, I'll save my parents some money. And when he dropped out, he was then able to take the classes and audit the classes for free that he never would have taken, like calligraphy, like typesetting and fonts and things like that. And he said he learned stuff that he would never, ever use in his life about type and fonts and calligraphy and things like that. And then 10 years later, when he was designing the Mac, he discovered that that was invaluable. And that was what made the Mac such a wonderful piece of equipment, and that is the fonts and the text and so forth that he never thought he'd use before. Mm-hmm. And his conclusion was, in retrospect, you don't know exactly the path you're being led on, but you will discover that in retrospect. So my advice to him is look in retrospect at your life. There are things that will happen or have happened to everyone that I think is the hand of that provider, that creator. Most of our doctors call it the hand of God in your life that you didn't realize that led you on the path to a successful conclusion in your life. I'm sure you've had those. I've had those things happen to me in getting into medical school.
Tell me.
I was a pre-med student in college, and I was taking all the pre-med classes, and they really weren't very exciting in most cases, although I love medicine. But some of these classes were, you know, all the chemistries and so forth that you have to take but you don't ever use in real life. And one of the classes I was taking was embryology. In embryology, you look at slides of like a snake or a lizard or something, and there are like 500 slides, and it's a little, and we're looking at the slides.
Right. We're like, oh, geez.
Yeah, and the night before the test, there's a girl across from me, and then we're sharing the microscope, and we're looking at the slides, and she says, isn't this wonderful? This is exactly what medical school is going to be like. And I almost threw up.
Right. Check, please.
The next day, I changed to economics. I became an economics major. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated with economics. I thought I'll never have to go to school again because I never really loved school very much. So I did my economics, got a job. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I really made a big mistake. You know, I wasn't doing anything good in the world, and I needed to go back to medicine. And so I had to take organic chemistry. Now, I had a family by this point, and so I gave myself one more year. If I didn't get into organic chemistry, I'd have to get a regular job and go on with my life and not be a doctor. So I discovered, thank goodness, there were two organic chemistry classes in Chicagoland that were offered at night. One was in Aurora University, and I was working at Aurora, so it was perfect. I could walk almost across the street to the college, and one at Roosevelt, which is downtown, as you know. So I got to the bookstore, I bought the books, and there were lots of books falling off the shelves. There were so many books, and I thought, oh, this is great. There must be lots of students enrolled. And I got to the class, there were three students there. And I thought, oh, this is great because I'll get personal attention. Well, the professor walked in and said, I'm sorry, we canceled the class. There are not enough students.
No.
I almost, I thought, my life is over.
Right.
You know? So I rushed down to Roosevelt the next morning, got in line to the registrar. And I finally got to the front of the line, and I said, I want to enroll in organic chemistry because I need to do that to you know, be a doctor, and otherwise my life will be a failure and so forth. And she said, I'm sorry, we have one full class. We opened up a second class, which is now full, and we have 10 students on the waiting list. And I said, well, you don't understand. And she said, no, everyone on the waiting list has the same story you do.
Yes, right.
And so I said, well, I was desperate. You know, my life was on the line, and I said, well, who makes the decision? Who makes the ultimate decision about who gets in?
Let me go over someone's head.
So she said, it's the professor. And I said, well, where does the professor live? She said, 302, go upstairs, and it's right there. So I ran upstairs. In the room where the professor was, the waiting room, there were tons of students. They were all over the place.
Right.
And I must have looked like a sad sap to the secretary there. And I said, I need to talk with the professor. If it give me 2 minutes, that's enough time. She said, okay, go to the ante room right outside the professor's office. The two professors that are teaching class are sitting in there right now talking about the class. Now, the door is paper thin, so I can hear everything going on. I didn't necessarily want to, but, you know, I'm sitting there. And the one professor is saying, I don't know what we're going to do. We don't have any books for this class. We've checked with the publisher. We've checked with all the universities in the area. No one has any books. We have a new class starting that we just opened up with 30 students. We have no books. And the professors were just totally distraught.
Right.
And so they shook hands finally and ended the conversation. And then the one professor signaled for me to come in. He was very bored. You know, he looked, I told him my story.
Yeah.
He was exhausted. And he said, I'm very sorry. And he told me the same story the registrar did and shook my hand and saw me out. And I said to myself, I've got to do something. This is my life on the line right here.
Right.
So I said to him with my heart in my throat, if I can get you the books, will you let me in? And all of a sudden, his eyebrows went up like yours.
Right.
His eyes opened up, and there was a long pause, and my heart was going higher and higher in my throat, and he said, "Can you get me 30?" And then I said, "More."
Right.
And then there was another long pause, and his eyes were opened up, and he said, "You're in." I got in. I told him where the books were. They got the books. Everyone was happy. Now, Jennifer, what do you think the likelihood, the coincidence, the infinitesimal coincidence that I would be there at this at the right time to hear that conversation when only I could help them and only they could help me?
That's right. That's right.
That was the hand of what I consider the hand of God.
Coming in and helping with your destiny to play out.
To allow me to get into medical school.
Exactly.
Because if I wouldn't have taken that class, I'd have a regular job and I wouldn't
You'd be an accountant somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we wouldn't have this book and we wouldn't have this conversation. I surely wouldn't know you because, no offense, but accountants aren't very exciting.
Well, usually internists aren't very exciting either.
No. So that's not true. My accountant Gary's wonderful. But no, I think that it's really important to note that we have these sort of like destiny points.
Yes.
Right, where we're supposed to, you were supposed to go to medical school. And
I think
the players on the other veil in this one were trying to basically collaborate for that. So if you're ever standing somewhere and you hear a conversation and your ears perk up and you're like, wait a minute. And then that's happened to me so many times. I just don't know which way to go if we're supposed, especially in this neighborhood here on Michigan Avenue. People are so lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just be standing there. And if you listen, put your peripheral vision on and your peripheral hearing on, you can help somebody and make their day.
Yes.
You know, they can walk around in circles and never find Navy Pier unless you help them out. And so I really feel like that can happen with bigger scope things, too, from down to, for some reason, I felt like I needed to be a traffic reporter when I was 25 and I was an actor and I was doing voiceover work. But why the heck would I want to make $8 an hour telling people about the outbound Kennedy?
Sure.
I just knew it was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
I just knew it. So I went, I interned, I then was hired. That's where I met the father of my child. You know, we were married for 13 years. We had a wonderful relationship and great friendship to this day. I was meant to meet him.
Yes.
And so it's like my radar was going off, become a traffic reporter, because I was meant to go that way,
exactly.
Right? And so for, again, the skeptic going, eh, get it, whatever. It's all fine and dandy, but that's just coincidence. Again, from a scientific standpoint in your medical world, what is a good example that really gets the doctors excited?
Oh, let's see. You know, the doctor, there's one good story about John Showalter, who's a hand surgeon. And John Showalter is one of the first hand surgeons to do what's called a hand replant, which is where a person cuts their hand off, and he was able to put it back together.
Wow.
And he told an interesting story about going to medical school, and he went to the University of Iowa and loved it there. And that's a great school.
Oh, sure.
It's a wonderful school. And he was an orthopedic resident there, or he was a medical student, I should say, and wanted to go into an orthopedic residency. So he applied to that school and others, and he thought he'd for sure get into the University of Iowa, which is his favorite school, and that's where he wanted to be. Well, he didn't get in. Now, it's unusual. John's a bright guy. I don't know what happened. They may have had too many people in the residency program or something, and they were limiting the students that year. But he got into the University of Indiana, and he said, that was the most disappointing part of my life. That was the... it was the greatest disappointment ever. But he went to the University of Indiana. Well, he discovered that there were only two universities in the country offering an interesting course at the time called microsurgery. Now, microsurgery is where you use a microscope to do very fine kinds of surgery, like reattach little tiny blood vessels and little tiny nerves and little tiny sinews and so forth. And so he learned that, and he loved it.
Right.
And that wasn't offered at the University of Iowa. It was just offered at the University of Indiana and one other university.
Wow.
And when he finished, he made a career out of doing microsurgery. And when a young kid saw the skill saw through his forearm in Lyle, Illinois, which is right by us.
Oh, sure.
They knew that John had that talent, and they called him up from the ER and said, "We've got a kid who just sawed his hand off. We stopped the bleeding. We put his hand on ice. Are you willing to take him on and do his surgery?" And he said, "I'd love to."
Oh, my goodness.
"I've never done it before, but I'd love to try." And he was the first person in Illinois, he says, to do this. So this is a while ago. So they sent the hand and the patient over to the operating room, and he started the surgery. And it was a 17-hour surgery. And the hospital provided all the meals, which were pizza. They had about 20 boxes of pizza that the doctors like to eat this very healthy food, as you know.
Oh, sure. Yes, yes.
And everyone was peeking their head in because this was history in the making.
Right.
And he was able, with microsurgery, to reattach the hand. Mm. And it was a success.
Nice.
And he slept there that night because he didn't want to leave the patient. And, he made history that day in sewing on a hand that he never would have been able to do had he gone to the University of Iowa. And so he finally concluded that greatest disappointment in his life was the greatest blessing in his life because he was able then, and he was guided to what he absolutely loved, and he's made his whole career out of doing microsurgery.
He wasn't where he was supposed to be in every moment.
Exactly.
Even when we doubt that.
Yeah.
Right? Wow. That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So
he's still doing that?
He's now retired.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a whole career, and he's helped a number of my patients and mm-hmm. lots of patients with the techniques that he learned when he wasn't supposed to.
So when it comes to other doctors and their beliefs of how we can heal, I recently interviewed a doctor named Dr. Jeffrey Rediger, Harvard Medical School psychiatry mm-hmm. faculty, and also at McLean, and he's doing research on unexplainable healings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those cases that people say, grade 4 glioblastoma,
right.
Pancreatic cancer, sorry.
Yeah.
But they're healing, and yes. a lot of it is because of their mental state and their positive attitude and the fact that they'll incorporate some alternative healing modalities that sort of get them in alignment. Are you a believer of the alternative healing modalities combining with the medical as well?
You know, I believe that we don't know everything about medicine.
Sure.
And I believe that if something works, I'm willing to accept it. So
sure.
There are so many things that we can't explain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I do believe some of those miracles are just, you know, the body revving up and so forth. But there are some of those that are truly miracles,
right.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those are some of the alternative things are responsible for those healings, too. So mm-hmm. I'm a pragmatist. I believe there are things that I don't know.
And also the results are results, too,
yes,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
And why should we claim to think we know everything when we can continue to gather data and learn more, right?
I agree.
I mean, I'm sorry, but in 1949, doctors were endorsing Camel cigarettes on TV.
I know.
This is the truth. Google it. It's all over YouTube. What Camel do you – or no, it's what cigarette do you smoke, doctor?
Right.
Well, 9 out of 10 doctors smoke Camels. I mean, this is – the nurses lighting the
yes.
cigarette. They're like, poof.
I have a book that endorses – this is the 1900s
–
endorses
yes.
smoking
sure.
as a means of treating bronchitis and pneumonias because it will kill the bacteria.
Oh, fabulous.
So there's some interesting things that we have believed over the years.
Because we do what we know at the time based on the research that we've gathered
yes.
at the time.
Yeah.
So do you think now that more people such as yourself are compiling these untold stories that the awareness will continue to grow? Can we have a conference of like minds where I think that unfortunately some people have given this world or these stories sort of a bad rap, if you will, and
mm-hmm.
they think that everybody's sort of like, you know, wearing patchouli and have dead chickens around their
yes.
neck.
Yeah.
And that's not the case.
Right. Right.
So the more that we talk about people in the medical community that have experienced these miracles, that are documenting these cases,
yes.
the more it will become a mainstream thing. I mean, if people believed 2,000 years ago that a man named Jesus came back from the dead, but we didn't have any way to document it digitally, no
right.
audio recordings,
right.
you know, but it's a belief system that 250 million people embrace.
Yes.
Why can't we take this evidence and embrace this?
That's the point of my book.
Got it.
Part of my book.
I knew that's why we were friends.
Yeah, and, you know, I picked the doctors that are just ordinary docs.
Yeah.
There are a number of docs that are kind of on the edge, you know,
mm-hmm.
and everyone knows that there's some doctors are really, you know, straight arrows and,
mm-hmm.
and kind of ordinary, boring doctors.
Traditional, yep. Mm-hmm.
And some doctors are a little bit on the edge. The doctors that are in this book are all ordinary doctors that have a practice, that have no reason to bring out an unbelievable story like this. As a matter of fact, they have every reason not to because
yeah.
they have stable practices. They're doing extremely well. They're well-liked in the community. And so they really stuck their neck out. And what happened at our launch was that people applauded them for being courageous to bring out these stories. And I'm convinced after talking to patients and talking to others that every individual or every family has a story like this.
Yes.
And if you give them permission by writing a book, by telling a story, that they will accept that and they will then come out with their story and feel okay about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal, I think, of the doctors was to give people permission to do that.
Yes.
And also to give them some hope.
Right.
There's something higher than us. Believe in that.
Right.
And many of the doctors didn't care what they believed, mm-hmm. As long as they believed in something, because it's a better world when people believe that there's something else higher than us that looks after us every single day
mm-hmm.
that may participate in our lives in strange and wonderful ways.
I'm sure you've heard of Dr. Raymond Moody, who coined the term near-death experience with his research over the decades since the 1970s.
Yes.
I interviewed him recently, and he says that a lot of the people claim these near-death experiences are a lack of oxygen in the brain. It's just hallucination and all
right.
that. Well, he has this really compelling story about how that could not be the case.
Mm-hmm.
He was at a conference in Italy, and he was operating, or this doctor in Italy came up to him and says, I have to tell you this story. This was the most unbelievable thing. Let's come over here. So the Italian doctor was working on someone, and he was a young man, pretty
mm-hmm.
healthy, but he went into arrest, and
yeah.
they could not revive him. And it was, they tried and they tried, and they're like, all right, let's call it time of death. And then they hear this ruckus, like a boom. This woman comes barreling in. It's his wife,
uh-huh.
who was in the waiting room just reading a magazine,
yeah.
who claims her husband, who died on the table, came to her and says, tell him to keep trying. It's not my time. I'm not dead yet. Tell him to try for 5 more minutes. So yes. she comes barreling in, screaming in Italian to keep
uh-huh.
trying.
Yeah.
So they're so rattled, they do.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, he
comes
came
back.
To and he says, I was trying to tell you I wasn't dead. You wouldn't listen. So I went to my wife in the lobby. And so, you know, Dr. Moody put that one in one of his
that's
books.
A great
and
story.
It was just like that was where that's the argument of, well, they were lacking oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she wasn't. She was in the lobby living life.
That's something.
And boom, he came in and says, honey, please tell him not to stop.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is. I think some of the experiences are lack of oxygen, you know.
Sure.
But I think, like Dr. Moody, there are many experiences that are not, and,
mm-hmm.
and you just can't explain those experiences. Yeah, what you can do is explain them by saying there's something that's beyond this, and that there's something that looks after us.
There's more going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I am applauding you for coming out with your stories, for continuing to tell them, for encouraging other physicians to do the same. We have a lot more stories to tell, so hopefully you'll have a series of books coming. But for the listeners who are driving, when you stop driving, go on Amazon and order Physicians Untold Stories by Scott J. Kolbaba. It's spelled K-O-L-B-A-B-A. And what website would you like them to go to? I'm sure you have many presences. Would you want them to find you on Facebook, find you at this? Where?
PhysiciansUntoldStories.com.
Okay, perfect.
And
perfect.
Look for our television show next year.
Okay, fantastic. I can't wait to hear that. I was going to ask you if you had a show in the works, but it's good to know you do.
Yep.
Okay. Because I was going to say this would be perfect for a series. You need to have a series talking about these things.
That's what Chris Fleming thought too. So.
Oh, see? All right. And other great minds think alike. Great. Well, I look forward to hearing more. I look forward to tuning in. For all of you out there, when you do go and order Dr. Kolbaba's book, you'll also see at the bottom to order mine. So do that. Get them both together. And they discount it. Psychics, Mediums, and Healers, A Journalist, A Road Trip, and Voices from the Other Side. We will continue to tell our stories, I have no doubt. And I hope we continue to be in touch, Doctor.
That's great. Thanks, Jennifer. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you for all that you do. And to all of you out there, treat others the way you'd like to be treated. And stay spiritual, damn it. We'll talk to you next time.